Good morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web around the world at KSFR.org. Later on in the program, Nancy London is going to be with us. She's the author of the book Hot Flashes, Warm Bottles, First-Time Mothers Over 40, and she's going to be talking about some of the writing workshops that she's got coming up. Right now, I'd like to welcome painter and Santa Fe living treasure, Marcia Muth. She's the author of the book A World Set Apart, Memory Paintings, published by Sunstone Press. And on Friday, the 23rd of March, this Friday, from 5 to 6:30, she'll be at Garcia Street Books, where there will be an exhibition of the paintings from her book, which runs through the 29th of March. Welcome, Marcia, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
It's great to have you here. Now, the book is titled Memory Paintings. What is a memory painting?
Well, a memory painting is exactly what it says. It's somebody's memory. In this case, this book is Memories of the 30s, a period which I was very familiar with, having grown up during that time.
So you spent your sort of childhood teenage years during the 30s. You were born in 1919 in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
That's correct.
What was it like for you? I mean, we think of the 30s as the Great Depression with tremendous hardship, the Dust Bowl, poverty. Your paintings are very optimistic.
Well, there was that side. I don't say, you know, I'm aware of that. But there was also a good side. That good side was the time of there was a great deal of neighborliness. There was actually a spirit of optimism in the country because we really thought things were going to get better. In fact, we thought technology would eventually solve all of our problems. And also, the 30s were a wonderful time. It was really, I'd say, the golden age of the movies, which I can see you're too young to remember. But at one time, first there were silent movies, and then suddenly there was something called talkies, which were talking pictures. And then by the end of the 30s came Technicolor. So it was really a wonderful time of new experiences.
Do you remember what it was like when you saw a movie for the first time?
Well, the first ones I saw were silent movies, and they were Westerns, and that they thought suitable for, you know, a young kid. And I was so thrilled that I stood up and pounded on the seat in back of me and yelled, "Hot dog!" And so that became my nickname for a while. And then the first talking picture I saw was only a part of a motion picture with a talking segment. And they asked me how I liked it, and I said, "Oh, it's a trick." I didn't believe it. I said there was somebody behind the curtain talking. And then later, of course, that became the movies were a great part of our life in the 30s.
Now, what was your life like in Fort Wayne? What did your parents do?
I lived with my grandparents, and they were retired. And really, when I look back, our lives were very simple, you know. We played games. There were some other children in the neighborhood. We did things, you know, after school. We played games. I played a lot of games of checkers with my grandfather. We listened to the radio, certain programs in the evening for a short time. Of course, there was no television, so families made up their own entertainment. And people did a lot of visiting. They would come to visit, or you would go to visit people's homes. And it was a very a peaceful time.
Now, you remember this time, and you chose to put that into paintings that you call memory paintings. How did you go about, jogging your memory or remembering this? Did you keep diaries? Did you keep artifacts from the time?
I've been very fortunate to have a good memory. I'm now 87. I still have a good memory. But when I was growing up, I wanted to be a writer. And I also grew up as the only child in a household of adults who believed children should be seen and not heard. And I had plenty of books to read, and I had paper to write, and I started writing stories. And I became an observer of what was then the adult world. And so I still can recall the houses I visited, the home we lived in, the way furniture was, and also the thrill of some of these we felt with the new things. When I was in like second grade probably, I remember the teacher saying, "Children, go to the window. There's an airplane going over." And this was a novelty, and it was a biplane, you know, one with two wings. And, you know, it was an adventure. And not, by the way, not everybody had an automobile. They were there. But we also, they talk about hybrid cars now. Well, when I was growing up, a lady in our neighborhood had an electric car.
Is that right?
Yes, and it sort of looked like it was high, had a lot of windows in it, and she drove it with sort of a stick thing. And she would take us for rides once in a while. And I was probably the only child that got a big thrill out of it. My friend that I grew up with said, "Oh, you can see the grass growing." But it was, you know, we had really the old world and the new world sort of combined.
There's a sense of wonder at things that seem simple.
Right.
To us now. And I wonder, so I was thinking about it, looking at your book, whether people who are, you know, 5 years old, 7 years old today experience that kind of wonder that you did.
I don't think so, because I know a few children, because my partner Jody is a cello teacher and has some children, but I don't think they have, I mean, she has children to teach, you know, they don't seem to have that wonder anymore because everything's right there. And television has led them to experience all sort of things. So nothing really thrills them.
Now, you started painting fairly late in life. You were in your 50s, I guess, when you started painting. How did this begin?
Well, years ago I had done some work as a silkscreen printing. And I gave it up because it got too hard for my hands. And then I became I thought I'd be a writer. In fact, I fancied being the great American novelist. Well, that didn't work out, but I did become an editor. And I wanted to do something, you know, after work that was different. And I thought, well, I've got to take up some kind of hobby. And I thought of what to do. Needlework was very popular, but I was a child forced to do embroidery, and I was terrible at it. And so I knew that ruled that out, but I always loved art. And so I thought, I'm going to secretly paint. And that's what I did. I started out with little 5x7 canvas panels, and I kept it a secret for quite a while because I thought if you didn't go to art school, you really can't be an artist. And
so do you consider yourself self-taught? Did you have anybody help you?
No. I even bought a couple books, but for some reason I couldn't translate what I read in the book to doing it. So I just did it. And then one day an artist who was well-known then in Santa Fe, George Wooliver, came to the house, and I didn't get a chance to put away my things. And he said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, I'm not doing anything." He said, "Let me see." And then he said, "Let me give you some advice. Don't take any lessons." And I did. I just learned. In fact, I'm still learning.
Now, you've been at this now for decades. Did you start with this memory painting idea?
Well, yes. I started painting factories, buildings, because I really didn't think I could draw very well. And I thought I was timid. I started that way. And I love factories. I grew up in an age, remember, when, despite the Depression and all, America was the greatest industrial nation. And then, of course, when the war started in Europe, in 39, we then became known as the Arsenal for Democracy. And it was, you know, we were proud of our factories. And even despite the labor trouble, there was, you know, a factory in a town was a big thing.
And when you say the labor trouble, what do you mean?
Well, there were unions, and the unions came in, and there were trouble. And then later on in the 40s, as unions began to organize, and undoubtedly they were needed because the workers' conditions were quite different from what they were later on. But people took pride in their local industry, and many industries were owned locally. Most of the stores were local stores, and you knew the people.
And that's very evident in your paintings. There's
right.
a sense of localism that goes really throughout all the paintings. There's a toy store and different kind of stores that people are in. There's even circuses. Was a circus?
Circus was very important to us. It was sort of a glamorous, exotic thing. Even though I lived in a modest-sized city, the circus came to town once a year. And they always had a circus parade so that people who couldn't afford to go to the circus could at least see the parade. Or you could go down and stroll around the grounds. And it was added a touch of exotic to us. Because anything from, except if you had a zoo in the town we lived in didn't have one. Later I lived in Buffalo, New York, where they had a zoo, which is nothing compared to the zoos today. You just went and looked at animals in cages. But other than that, you counted on the National Geographic to give you some glimpses of the outer world.
Have you been reading National Geographic for a long time?
Well, we took it at home, you know, for years. It was a standard magazine that families like to take because it brought the outside world into our purview. And it was our one, because, you know, you couldn't turn on the television. There wasn't any such thing. You just depended on pictures.
We're talking to Marcia Muth. She's a painter in Santa Fe Living Treasure, and on Friday, this coming Friday, from 5 to 6:30, she will be at Garcia Street Books, where there will be an exhibition of paintings from her book, which is called A World Set Apart, Memory Paintings, published by Sunstone Press. Now, do you feel nostalgic for that time?
Well, no. I mean, today, I'd really be disappointed if I had to give up my microwave, for example. And although I'm disappointed in television, there are certain programs I wouldn't want to be without. And I love DVDs. You can see, you know, all sorts of programs now and movies and all without going away from home. And so I think there are many good things that I wouldn't want to give up. But I wish we had some of the same feeling of neighborliness and security we had in those days. I mean, you didn't worry if you left your groceries outside, but, you know, went in the house for something. When you came back, they were still there. Also, there were a lot of conveniences that we don't have now. We had mail delivery twice a day. The milkman came to the house. If you wanted your clothes dry cleaned, you called the dry cleaner who picked them up and brought them back. I mean, it was a different world. But no, I'm living in today, and I wouldn't want to give up some of the things we have now.
You moved to Santa Fe in the 1960s.
1966.
What brought you here?
Well, like many people, I came here for health reasons, and it was suggested that I go to a drier climate. And I had been coming out here for 5 or 6 years as a tourist, and I fell in love with it, as all people do. And I thought, oh, I'm going to retire there, because everybody I saw that was older, they looked pretty vigorous, if somewhat wrinkled, but I figured, oh, well, it's the dry climate. So when the doctor said, why don't you go somewhere else? I said, fine. And I had friends here, and I told them I was thinking of moving. And they told me I was a librarian. There was a new state library building. It just opened then. And I came out, had an interview, and got hired.
And so, in addition to being an artist, you've been a librarian. Is that your life's work?
Yes, I was a librarian. I graduated from the University of Michigan and worked there and at the University of Missouri. I was actually a law librarian. But when I came out here, I worked at the state library. And I was also the librarian at the history library here at the Palace of the Governors.
Now, how did life in Santa Fe compare to what you'd known before, Buffalo and Fort Wayne?
Well, it was a bit of a shock to live here. It's different to be a tourist. At first, I was used to the academic life for one thing. I was used to the city, being near museums, and it was kind of a shock. But later, it became home, and I love it. I think we have the most wonderful climate in the world, and we're friendly people, so it's home to me.
Some subjects of Santa Fe, not a lot, but there's a little bit of Santa Fe that creeps into your memory paintings.
Right. I have done Pueblo paintings also. Well, yeah, I live here, so obviously this is now part of my life.
But you sort of transform it and mix it with the 30s motif.
Right. Well, I'm still a Midwesterner at heart, I suppose. You never get away from that.
Was Santa Fe, when you moved here, more of the kind of neighborly place that you were used to?
It was, because all the stores on the plaza practically were home-owned. And most of the people I knew, because I belonged to Temple Beth Shalom at the time, and most of the people who owned the stores were there. So it was friendly, and you met people at places and you start up a conversation, and you didn't worry about your door being locked or your car being taken away or anything like that. It was my idea of a nice small town. It was about 30,000 some then.
We're talking to Marcia Muth. Who were your, I know you're self-taught, but who were your influences as painters? I was looking at the work and thinking that there is a similarity to some of the painters who painted in the 30s.
Well, I like Norman Rockwell, naturally, because I thought he did the American scene very well. And I like Edward Hopper. And I think it's certain realism. I'm open to all forms of art. I enjoy all forms. But I think I tend toward more Grant Wood, for example, John Stuart Curry, Thomas Hart Benton. They were the prominent painters in the 30s. Regional art, which became very big during the 30s. And I think they captured the feeling of the country, especially at that time.
Now, you've chosen to use a kind of, what would you call it, non-perspective, flat way of painting and laying out your subjects almost on a flat surface.
Well, that's because I don't know perspective. I don't know how I do what I do. People always say, well, why did you do it that way? I can't really explain it. I follow my intuition in the use of color and space, and if it looks right, then it's okay.
Now, how did you become a Santa Fe living treasure? Tell us about that whole process.
Well, gee, I don't know. All of a sudden, I'm older and I'm a treasure. I was very appreciative of the honor and very thrilled by it. I don't know. I've just been here living my life, I guess. I like to encourage older people as well as younger people, especially older people. To do things. I taught Elder Hostel for 12 years, Elder Hostel classes at the College of Santa Fe, which gave me a chance to encourage older people, which at that time some were older than I was, most of them, and to do something. I don't like to see older people just sit down and do nothing.
Now, have there been any, if you're a, let's say, ballet dancer, you have to retire at a certain point. If you're a painter, you really don't.
No, a painter or writer can go on as long as they're, I suppose if their mind gets a little flaky, they could still do something. Oh, it wouldn't be, very good maybe. But, yeah, a painter doesn't ever have to quit. I still paint every day.
Do you really?
Yeah.
What size canvases do you work on now?
Well, I work on smaller ones. Probably I prefer something 18 by 24, 24 by 36. I used to do 3 by 5 painting, 3 feet by 5, 4 by 5. But, I'm a little slower now, and I want to be able to live to finish a painting. And I do a lot of commission work through people. This has been an interesting aspect of my career, which I'd never planned on.
Tell us more about that.
Well, I've been asked to do other people's memories, really. one of them.
Now, that's tricky business.
Well, not if they can talk about it, I can also visualize. Remember, I was once going to be a writer, so in a way, I'm still using that. But I've done a lot of family businesses for people who wanted to commemorate a business that had been in the family and either has been, they retired or it's been sold. I'll give you one example. A family asked me to do a bakery for them. Family had a bakery in New York. It was the New York Model Bakery. And what they wanted was both the bakery where they worked and the front part where they sold the products. And I did do that, and it turned out very well. And I've done dress shops, fur shops, grocery stores. And it's been interesting because it's in the 30s, so it's a thing. I have been to places like that, so I can follow their thoughts. And what they put in is like special things, like in my grocery store, they said we had a little post office to one side. So I did that. You see, it's just putting yourself in the place of the person, but it's always in the 30s, so it combines my experience with theirs.
Did they ever provide you with photographs?
Rarely. Once in a while. I did a drugstore once, and they had a photograph. Unfortunately, it's pretty dark, but it gave me an idea of sort of the layout of the store. And I love to do soda fountains. I love to do diners. Diners were very popular. They've come back in popularity. But they were wonderful places, and I've probably done 30 or 40 diners in my life so far.
So what are you working on now?
I just finished a picture of trees. I suddenly had a great fascination with just trees. I did a winter scene of some trees in the snow. I'm working on an opera scene. It's an opera rehearsal of the opera Salome with the people on stage getting ready for the dress rehearsal and the orchestra. I'm just starting work on the orchestra as the members come in, straggle in for the dress rehearsal.
Well, Marcia Muth, it's time to go, but I want to thank you so much for spending this time with us here on KSFR.
Well, thank you very much, Mary Charlotte. I've enjoyed it.
I have too, and the book is wonderful. It's called A World Set Apart, Memory Paintings by Marcia Muth. The paintings themselves will be on sale and displayed from this coming Friday, the 23rd of March, through the 29th of March at Garcia Street Books. And Marcia Muth will be there at Garcia Street Books from 5 until 6:30 this coming Friday. Garcia Street Books is on Garcia Street. The book is published by Sunstone Press right here in Santa Fe. Thanks again, and we will see you on Friday night.
Thank you.
We're going to take a little break right now, and when we come back, we'll be speaking with Nancy London. Stay tuned.
KSFR programming is underwritten in part by Body, local spa, yoga, Nia, and organic cafe. Kane Mathis plays an African Kora concert at Body Saturday, March 24th at 8 p.m. Kane has studied music in Africa for 15 years and played the Kora, a traditional 21-string African harp, for U.S. and Gambian ambassadors. Starting this month, Body also offers an expanded cafe menu, more seating, and live music at dinner. For information, 986-0362 or bodyofsantafe.com.
Is there something you'd like to tell us? I'm Dale Dierman, KSFR General Manager. As we get ready for our spring on-air fund drive later this month, we've installed a new comment line. It's 428-1180. That's 428-1180. You can call the comment line anytime and leave a voice message. We'd like to know why you think it's important to support Santa Fe Public Radio. And we'd like to play your comments for our listeners. This is the time to tell us what you think. Leave your message day or night on the KSFR comment line at 428-1180.
KSFR programming is underwritten in part by Garcia Street Books, located at 376 Garcia Street, where Santa Fe living treasure Marcia Muth will launch A World Set Apart, Memory Paintings, on Friday, March 23rd at 5 p.m. And on Saturday, March 24th at 5 p.m., John Agresta will celebrate his national book launch of Mugged by Reality, The Liberation of Iraq and the Failure of Good Intentions. More information at 986-0151 or garciastreetbooks.com.
I'd like now to welcome Nancy London. She's a writer and therapist. She's co-author of the original Our Bodies, Ourselves, and is the author of the book Hot Flashes, Warm Bottles, First-Time Mothers Over 40, and she's going to be teaching a word harvest writing workshop that we'll be talking about in a few minutes. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here.
It's great to have you here, too. Lots of different things to talk about. Let's start at the beginning, or maybe the beginning. How did you get involved with Our Bodies, Ourselves?
Well, I was living in Cambridge, Massachusetts at the time, and became part of what was historically the first women's consciousness raising group, women sitting around the kitchen table going, oh, my God, that happened to you, too. And
you know, there's probably a lot of our listeners have not actually been part of those groups. I wasn't. What were they like? What were you actually talking about? We're talking about what, the mid-late 60s, early 70s?
Very late 60s. Well, you know, up until that time, the housewife of the 50s, she was our mom. She was living in a nuclear family, kind of cut off from the sisterhood, as it came to be known. And so for women to get together and break down the traditional barriers of thinking of themselves as a wife and a mother and not so much an independent woman with her own life story, and to begin to talk about our life stories, it was radical at the time.
What kind of things came out, and above all, what kind of emotions came out?
Oh, what a probing question. Well, you know, I mean, we talked about everything. We talked about our bodies. We talked about our sex lives. We talked about money. We talked about all the big taboos. We talked about relationships with men. We talked about a vision for ourselves that was broader than simply marriage and motherhood. And it was exhilarating. And out of that, the notion of writing about some of those things. In fact, the first working title of the book was Women and Their Bodies. And I remember the moment when we all sat around laughing our heads off, going, oh, my God, it's our bodies, not their bodies.
Very interesting.
So, it was a kind of owning of ourselves as women.
Now, were you a health care person in any way? Or
a social worker.
Or a social worker.
Which I still am now.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And so how did you and how did all the other women who did this book, Our Bodies, Ourselves, which has so much medical information in it, get up to speed on the real nuts and bolts of the medical part of it?
Well, that was a lot of research. The Boston Women's Health Book Collective became a very professional, very studied group of women. They still are together. I left after the first edition and moved to California. They stayed together, and I think they just put out the 20th edition. It's been translated into many, many, many languages. And interestingly enough, it has to be adapted for each country because in countries where there's food shortage and women are scrambling to feed themselves and their families, the sections on overeating and binge eating are so inappropriate that, you know, you really have to modify. Yeah, you have to modify what you... Yeah, exactly.
Right,
exactly.
So, what did you do after that? You moved to California.
I moved to California and became an herbalist. I ran an herb store in Santa Cruz, California. It was the 70s, so I had the requisite guru and spiritual community experience. I'm the poster girl for the boomer generation. And after 16 years in California, my husband and I moved to Maui because I was a habitual miscarrier. I had had 5 miscarriages, and I was really trying to have a baby. And so we just kind of got out of the mainstream boogie and went and hung out on an island and had a baby at home with a midwife.
Really? Moving to Hawaii actually worked?
It did. It really did.
Why do you think that was?
It's just less stress, more ocean, more relaxation.
Do you think the stress was causing you to have miscarriages?
I think it was part of it. I also think that, once again, the traditional ways of dealing with certain medical conditions from a Western, maybe male point of view, seemed a bit inadequate. I mean, the things that I learned about why women miscarry certainly helped me not miscarry again.
And what were, besides the stress, what were some of those things?
Well, it's a progesterone deficiency. And so, you know, I just learned how to supplement and do things in a slightly different way than simply continuing to keep trying without educating myself, which was the whole point of Our Bodies Ourselves, which is let's take control of our health care and find out what's going on and do some research and ask the right questions. So.
Was it hard to learn those lessons even though you'd been involved in the health book collective?
It's always hard. You always want there to be someone who knows more. You're always looking for the expert. But I think that, you know, at this point there's so much information available on the internet and, you know, there's such a wealth of resources that I think that as women we're quite capable of educating ourselves about almost anything.
Right? Yeah, the extent to which people can successfully self-diagnose at this point because of the internet is probably a little scary.
And look for alternatives. Yeah. You know, I think no matter what your doctor says you have or need, I think that it's really important that we do our own research and go, well, okay, now this drug has these side effects, and so are there alternatives to taking something like that that I'm bound to for the rest of my life? So, you know,
now,
lots of choices.
We're talking to Nancy London. You do, among many other things, retreats, I guess you would call it, where you take people to Hawaii to swim with dolphins and do a writing workshop.
I just got back less than a week ago.
Oh, that's why you're suntan.
That's why I'm suntan. It was really unbelievably fabulous. Four women from Santa Fe, one from Arizona, one from Santa Cruz, plus myself and my husband, who is the cook, piled into this wonderful big house on the ocean, on the big island, where the weather is so beautiful, the houses don't have windows, they have screens just to keep the bugs out, swam with dolphins, and wrote in the afternoon, ate great food, took naps, really had a good time.
So, miniature short-term paradise, it sounds like.
Yeah, it was. It was a lot of fun. We're doing another one the end of October, as a matter of fact. So,
now, when people do a writing workshop after having swum with dolphins, how does it affect their writing?
That's a really good question. You know, I came with lots of different ideas because I do writing workshops here in town, and so there's a lot of different ways of approaching different subjects, different ways of looking at our life story, because that continues to be what interests me, is how we narrate our life story and how many different ways are there to look at it. And one of the things that people say about the dolphins is that they provide this multidimensional experience where their sonar, for one thing, when their sonar starts hitting your body, it's the most ethereal experience to have 200 dolphins sonaring you at one time.
Can you feel it?
You can absolutely feel it. I mean, they are x-raying you. And there are stories, of course, from people who say that the dolphins came and nudged them in spots where they later found they had these little tumors growing. And they can see, you know, using sonar. That's how they get around. They bounce their x-ray off of things.
Well, sonar and x-ray aren't the same thing.
No, they're not the same thing exactly, but it's the way they navigate underwater is through sound. And so you're having such a multidimensional experience in the water with them, and who you thought you were or who you think you are begins to break down. And so that's what I kind of geared the whole writing experience around, was the multidimensional self. And how many selves are we, really? You know, there's the one that walks around Santa Fe and does her food shopping and goes to the co-op and the dry cleaners and all that. But then there's Island Girl, and she started emerging. You know, women would come to the writing, you know, the first day kind of in their jeans and, you know, whatever. And the next day, well, maybe a skirt. And by the third and fourth day, we were all in sarongs with flowers in our hair, you know. So there are these personalities that emerge. And we name them, so by the fourth and fifth day, the dinner table had not only the eight of us, but then there'd be, you know, another eight. You know, there was Marilyn, and then there were, you know, all these hilarious characters that were emerging in our writing, so it was really delightful.
Now, when you sort of become aware of or cultivate other personas, I think probably most of us walk around with one basic persona,
right,
or maybe two. If you're a teacher, you've got your strong teacher persona, and then you go home and you're...
That's
but
right.
When you do all these other things, what does it do to you? What's the benefit of it? How does it change you?
Well, here's the benefit. A lot of times we walk around and you have this sense that something's missing, or you feel maybe depressed or a little angry, or you'll notice that you're snippy or overeating, or, you know, there are all these symptoms. And what the writing hopes to do is identify who's not getting her needs met. And so by the end, when all these characters have had a chance to speak through writing, and they're powerful. I mean, it's one of the things I'm doing with the Word Harvest workshop is how to look at our story from multiple perspectives. And who else was there when we experienced a certain event? You know, there were other parts of ourselves present. And so once these characters get named and you identify what kind of clothes she wears, like one of the funny things was almost every woman there said that there was a part of their closet that belonged to another one of those characters. You know, they tended to wear kind of conservative Santa Fe clothes, but if you looked in the back of their closet, there were some pretty wild, you know, outfits back there. And so who bought those clothes?
Right, right.
And so by the end, what we tried to do was make a list of who needs what, you know, and then look at that list every day and go, okay, who do I need to attend to today? Is it just the social worker, or does Island Girl need a little time up at 10,000 waves? Or,
right.
You know, how do I become whole through the integration of other selves is really the goal.
Well, how does the integration part of it work? I mean, you're identifying these separate personalities. What is the, how do you bring them together if you do?
Well, I had everybody make this very comprehensive list. And a lot of people broke it down by different selves, so that the one in me who has traditionally been, I mean, I was an herbalist for many years and knew a lot about medicinal wild plants, but she's been very dormant here in Santa Fe as my writing has become more foreground in my social work. And so you end up with a very comprehensive list of needs. My herbalist self really needs more time out in the woods with wild medicinal plants.
Right.
And so you post a list. You simply post a list of all these needs and wants from all these disparate selves. And you take a look on a particular day when there might be a little bit of time, or your mood might be shifting, and you might find that you're kind of a little out of sorts, and what is it? And you can scan your list and you go, ah, there she is. She's the one who needs attention today.
Now, this sounds distinctly like women's activity. I mean, is this something that you pretty much do with women? Are there men out there who take your workshops and look at their different selves?
I do it with women.
Yeah.
Yeah. My work is with women, and it always has been. My husband, he went through a few changes as the only male, but he was cooking such phenomenally great food that, you know, he kind of slipped into the group.
Right, right. Now, we're talking to Nancy London. You wrote this book called Hot Flashes, Warm Bottles. You yourself had your first child over the age of 40?
I did. It's called Hot Flashes, Warm Bottles, First Time Mothers Over 40. And because I was miscarrying so often, it took me until I was 44 to have my child. And then, you know, late 40s, when my hormones began shifting, it was a very different universe. I needed more time alone. I needed stuff I didn't even know how to name. And, you know, went looking in all the bookstores for books about women who had children over 40, and there weren't any. You know, the books for women over 40 assumed her kids were grown. And so there were a lot of great suggestions like hydroponic gardening and calligraphy, you know, and I had a toddler. And then the books for parents were written by and large for much younger women. And so I started support groups. I put a little ad in the paper here and said, hey, is there any other woman out there who had their child over 40 and like to get together?
And you were deluged.
I was deluged. There's a huge demographic here in town. And after running several of those groups, six-week groups, I realized the issues were always the same. It was fatigue. It was really kind of surprised at how needs changed, where when you were in your early 40s, you felt really vital. Couldn't wait to have a child, and then late 40s, more fatigue, certainly more need for solitude than you might have imagined when you were trying to have a child, diminished sex drive with a 4-year-old, you know, which is true for younger women as well, but extremely pronounced when your hormones are shifting. And so I thought, wow, if this is true for me and these women here, it must be true for other women. And, of course, it was and is. And I still get letters and emails from women across the country thanking me for normalizing what they're experiencing,
right.
You know, and, which was the point.
Yeah, and it's work that people, women in particular, sort of born toward the beginning of the baby boom have done to make it easier for everybody who comes later. You really, like, as in the consciousness-raising groups of the 60s, are sort of pioneering this stuff.
I know. I do feel that way. I feel that I'm bizarrely typical of a generation, and even of a generation that postponed motherhood. Certainly the women's movement, you know, provided opportunities that our mothers never had to work and travel and live communally and decide not to have children right away in their 20s. And so women who became, you know, got to their late 30s, early 40s, who decided, well, now that I've done everything else, I'll have a child, and couldn't conceive because of diminishing fertility. Boom, there's the whole infertility clinic phenomenon,
right.
You know, that sprung up in response to a generation that postponed motherhood. So,
and also, to some extent, I think women were a little bit sold a bill of goods by a movement that said, you can do anything whenever you want to.
That was the most poignant thing in my research for my book, was sitting with women and talking to women on the phone who cried and said, I feel betrayed by the women's movement.
Yeah.
You know, nobody told me my fertility was declining. Nobody told me that I couldn't have it all at any moment, that I decided, oh, now what I want is a child. So, you know, I felt not exactly personally responsible, but it was poignant.
You've identified a lot of the problems that women have when they give birth over the age of 40. What are some of the solutions? How are women dealing with that?
Well, I think education, again, you know, if we understand what we're choosing. You know, you may be 35 years old and not ready to have a child. If you understand that statistically you may end up in an infertility clinic, you may end up adopting.
No, but I mean, what if you, when you, let's say you have this child, you're 49 years old, you're tired, you want to be alone, and you've got a, you know, pair of screaming twins.
Support groups.
Really? That makes
oh, yeah.
a big difference.
It makes a huge difference. First of all, because if your friends are younger, they're not going to exactly know what you're talking about. Whereas when women who are over 40 with their first child come to a support group, the relief that they feel being able to be honest about what they're experiencing, it's enormous. Support groups.
So just being heard. I mean, being heard doesn't really solve the problem of fatigue or not enough time or not enough money, but still just being heard does something.
Well, being heard plus forming bonds with women in your same situation and then working out trades. Childcare trades, you know.
Right.
I see women, you know, that have come through my groups do that a lot. They'll really spell each other. When one woman is just going through a hard time, her friends will be there picking her kid up, you know, taking her away for an afternoon or something. It's the sisterhood. It's what's needed.
We're talking to Nancy London, and on Saturday, not this Saturday, but the next one, the 31st of March, you'll be teaching a word harvest writing workshop called Descansos, The Power of Our Personal Story.
Yep, it's really interesting. Women will be creating a timeline of their lives and marking, much the way Descansos mark transitions on the roadsides of New Mexico, marking the major transitions of their lives. And revisiting with all kinds of very, very fun writing experiences these places of transitions and crossroads and places that need maybe another perspective or healing or blessing or maybe another self that was there at the time that didn't get to speak wants to come and say what it was like for her. And she needs some healing and blessing. So.
And so that's what this writing workshop is about. It's a one-day workshop?
It's a one-day workshop, 9 to 4. If people want to know more about it, they can go online. It's wordharvest.com, WORDHARVEST, one word, or call Word Harvest, 471-1565. It's 9 to 4. Lunch is included.
And that's on the 31st of March.
Saturday.
When you've done this before, how do people respond? Again, is it for women only?
This is not for women only, and I honestly don't know if there are any men who've enrolled. That would be really interesting for me. It's wonderful. You know, we do some writing exercises, for instance, telling a story of your life, one of the major stories. And these kind of crossroads are stories that we've told many times. They're often the stories that we tell new acquaintances as a way of introducing ourselves, or saying, this is who I am, this is where I come from. But if you put the pen in your non-dominant hand and tell the story from a place of right brain experience rather than the left brain that controls your dominant hand.
Even if I'm right-handed, I'm actually writing my story with my left hand?
Yeah, you retell the story with your left hand.
Uh-huh.
And I have seen women look really skeptical, like, what good is this? And it's astonishing what emerges. The story gets told from a very different perspective.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I would think it would be shorter because it would take you so much longer to...
It's a lot shorter, and it cuts to the bone of what another self, usually the feeling self, experience. Because a lot of times we tell the habitual story, and the feeling is what gets drained out of it. You're left with the facts and the details. And the non-dominant hand will often hold the feeling of it. So it's very powerful and very simple.
And so
one of the things we'll do on the 31st.
what is the outcome of it? Do you teach people to bring this particular kind of writing into their everyday lives?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's very short. It's called writing practice, you know, where I will suggest a theme, and then we write for 10 or 15 minutes, maybe 20, nonstop, no editing, no going back and seeing if you can find a better word. This isn't so much to perfect a piece as to allow your creativity to help you explore your psyche. And so there's no feedback. We're not there to tell someone their piece was great or it could have been better.
But you do share them with each other.
We read out loud, but we read without feedback, which makes for safety. I really believe in safety in these experiences because we're not just trying to describe something apart from ourselves. We are describing and exploring ourselves. And so that's a very vulnerable, tender, delicious place to be with a group. And so my job is to keep it safe.
Now, do you ever... Maybe this is a stupid question, but with all this focus on the self and the psyche, do you ever get just tired of exploring the self?
No, it's always new. And I write with everybody. I write and read. I don't sit apart from the group. I'm right in there, you know, laughing and sweating through, you know, my own journey. And so obviously I've done the same exercises more than once, and it's always new. The psyche always has something new to say. It's looking for the opportunity to speak. It doesn't want to say what it said 6 months ago. There's new experience. There's new life. There's new vision. There's new joy.
Right, right.
So it's yearning to say something new. And so if it knows that it's not going to be censored and that your critic has been left at the door and, you know, the objective is to just play with words and have fun expressing yourself, then the creativity really can explore and run, you know.
Do some of your students take this work as a basis and go toward more crafted writing?
Absolutely. It's a wonderful way to deal with writer's block because if you're stuck somewhere, you can say to yourself, okay, I'm a little bit stuck on this scene or this particular idea. I'm going to give myself permission to write for 20 minutes, nonstop. No, I'm not going to lift my pen up. I'm just going to write, and we'll see what happens. And at the end of 20 minutes, you're not only unblocked, but somewhere in the middle of what you've written is something, a real gem, and you go, aha, there it is. That's my next idea. So,
interesting.
It's the permission.
Right.
You know, it's the permission to not be a critic.
Right, right. Do you point, I mean, I'm, you don't have feedback with one another, but do you ever point out that gem, like that's the kernel of the piece?
No, we don't, actually, because the next person who's going to read may be sitting there thinking, well, I don't have a gem in my piece. And I really want to avoid that.
Right, right.
I mean, I've had my turn, you know, where people around me have written things and read things that are completely brilliant, and I've had a fairly uninspired morning, and it's like my turn to read, and I'm thinking, boy, I'm really glad there's no feedback here.
Right, right, right.
So it's safety.
We're talking to Nancy London. We've just got a minute or two left. What are you working on now? Do you have any of your own writing projects going?
I do. I'm just finishing up a young adult fiction book on interspecies communication.
Ah, about which you know a thing or two. Is it about dolphins?
Well, there are dolphins in the book, but it's really about the whole complete entire animal world that is waiting for us to figure out that they're trying to communicate with us and, you know, need our help to not be completely extinct in the next 20 years. It started out as a bedtime story for my daughter.
Wow.
And it went on for years and years. And it's called Fifi and the Secret Outlaw Society. And so I'm just finishing that up now.
And we will be happy to have you back when it's published one
Thank
of these
you.
Days.
So here's, can I give out the word harvest phone number again? It's 471-1565.
And the website is wordharvest.com.
And the workshop, Saturday, March 31st, 9 to 4.
9 to 4. Nancy London, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Nancy London is a writer. She's a therapist. She's the co-author of the original Our Bodies, Ourselves, and the author of Hot Flashes, Warm Bottles, First Time Mothers Over 40. The workshop is called Descansos, The Power of Our Personal Story, and wordharvest.com, 471-1565. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We are on the web at ksfr.org. Check out our really fabulous website. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz with John Greenspan presents the monthly New Orleans Hour, and Giants of Jazz pays tribute to George Gershwin. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte, and we will see you tomorrow right here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. We're broadcasting Monday through Friday. Adios.